This is the way it feels to move through summer in Lululemon. Iconic align softness without the front seam. For our smoothest look and feel ever, summer won't know what hit it. Stretch your limits in the non-stop flexibility of the new Lululemon Align No Line Pant in select stores and at lululemon.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest on my podcast this week is Matt van Italy, founder and CEO of Seema.
What I know now that I didn't know as a baby entrepreneur was there are so many different versions of no, except here is some money. Here is the money. Everything else is no. I love it. So interesting. I can really see this helping. This solves a pain point. Yes, I want to pilot. Yes, I want to tell my friends. That's all no. It's all versions of no, except here is some money.
This is Matt. He has a diverse background spanning law, consulting, education and tech, and has held leadership roles in edtech and govtech companies like Social Solutions and PeopleAdmin. He's earned his JD from Harvard Law School after studying history at Swarthmore College. He's also a thought leader on the impact and responsible adoption of AI in the tech industry. And this multidisciplinary experience gives him a unique perspective as a tech founder and CEO. In September 2017, he founded Seema, a code-based scanning tool, and their mission? To bridge the gap between the technical and non-technical worlds, particularly in the context of software development. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Matt to my podcast. We explore how most tech organizations carry more and more depth in their codebase and the business risks this brings. Matt shares his vision on how to solve this in a world where AI-generated code and open source is rapidly gaining popularity. He discusses the learning process he had as a founder in creating a singular, non-consensus vision for the company, and how their unusual approach upfront helped them gain deep differentiation and first-mover advantage. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how he uncovered a new, totally overlooked target market, where his product quickly became mission-critical rather than a nice-to-have. Secondly, why he's prioritizing building trust-based relations with key players in the industry and how he's achieving this. Thirdly, what he's doing differently around creating a team that is more than the sum of its parts. And lastly, his recommendations on choosing your business model wisely. Well, hi, Matt. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's going to be such a pleasure.
Yeah, that's. I've been looking forward to this. I got the introduction through someone else, and I was looking into what your company Seema was actually up to, and it brought back so many memories from my history in enterprise software space, acquiring companies, looking into like is the code really that good? These type of things, and you created a solution for that. I wished that was available, let's say 10, 15 years ago. But apparently it wasn't. So before we start talking about your company, first a question to you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I love tackling a hard problem that matters. I think entrepreneurship gives that opportunity. Not every problem is hard, not every problem matters, but certainly if you pick, like I've picked, problems that are not trivial and really could make a difference for the world, entrepreneurship really gives you a chance at building something meaningful. I also love building great teams and helping in great individuals, help them be better as individuals, but also being more than the sum of their parts as a team together. And that feeling, and of course, as the founder and CEO, I really get to shape the culture and the operating system of the company so that we're building a team that's as good as it can be and more than the sum of its parts through my vision. And that is absolutely exhilarating. And so between meaningful impact and building a great team, I just love getting to do what I do.
Well, the passion is actually, it's like it's screaming from the screen here. And I think if you do those things together, yeah, you can actually make things happen that weren't possible before and do that in a better way than anyone else does. We will talk about my book a little later, The Remarkable Effect, but it brings back a lot of connotations with that. So you started your business in September 17. And I mean, what I've been looking and studying on your website today is all about generative AI code generation and see whether there are risks in that. Of course, that is at that point in time, it was really early. What was the big problem, the hard problem, as you said, that was screaming for a solution that you've created?
Sure. So I think it is most sensible to break it into two parts, mapping the two products that we've built along the way. Mm-hmm. The product that we started in 2017, and I'm so honored and proud to say it's doing quite well today, that one, we call it comprehensive code base scans, or I'll just say code scans. The problem that was answering was, how can a CTO summarize the state of engineering comprehensively and accurately to the other members of the executive team and to the board of directors? Well, I sometimes summarize that as executive insight into code. Mm-hmm. You are, and your listeners are very familiar with tools that are executive insight into sales. Salesforce, every CRM. It is for sure a tool for salespeople to do their work. It is for sure a way for sales managers to understand what's going on and where they're heading. But it is finally a roll-up that gives the most important points so that the rest of the C-suite can understand and the board of directors can understand. And I was a software executive, frankly, just struggling with the absence of executive insight into code. CFOs, boards of directors, just didn't have the technical detail to understand what was really going on with engineering. And I observed CTOs having random spreadsheets and, speaking qualitatively about what was going on with the code, when, of course, very ironically, coders have built executive insight tools for every other department. The expression, the cobbler's sons go barefoot. The fact that CTOs didn't have a CTO dashboard, even though they had built CXO dashboards for everybody else, was crazy. So that was the first one. And then this second product, on Gen AI code detection, that burning question, and huge kudos to our amazing customers who requested that we build it, is how do we know how much Gen AI code is in our code base as opposed to the code that our humans wrote? And is it being used in a safe way safe and appropriate? So are we using it in a way that gives us the productivity gains that we want, so the upside, while also managing the very real risk when people aren't using it the right way?
Very important. But I still think there's a lot of value for the CTO as well to understand, like, what is really the risk of a particular at any point in time, and where should you devote the resources to pay attention to and whatnot? Because at the end, there's never enough resources. I mean, I came from an organization that was about 4,000 people when I left, and Yeah, I mean, people think, okay, you got an extremely big development department for one product that was 300 people, and we were always screaming like we need 300 more. And it has to do, of course, with how good the code is. So where do you lose and waste money and waste precious productivity? But these days, of course, with cloud technology, it has way broader impacts than before. Because I mean, I actually, when I started, it was all on premise. And then you worry about it sometimes a little less. But today, yeah, it's critical. So yeah, understand the big idea behind it, and yeah, fascinating how you actually bring that to the conversation with the board. Did you experience that CTOs, because they were not able to explain what the status of the code was to the board, that they didn't get the resources, they didn't get the budget, that priorities got changed? Is it those type of things? What did it really help with?
That's such a great question. You're absolutely right. That being, it's very frustrating for CTOs to not be able to, frustrating for anybody to not be able to be understood. CTOs are no exception. And the result in an ongoing setting of CTOs not being able to get their point across is absolutely an underinvestment in, to be fair. Sometimes what engineering teams ask for is not always necessary. We like to say that code should be carrying debt, certainly code quality debt, even intellectual property risk debt, just like businesses should be, carrying debt in almost all circumstances. So just because engineers want it doesn't mean it necessarily is affordable in the circumstances. But as a general rule, most organizations carry more debt in the code base than they should, and bringing more visibility helps bring it to light. That said, so that's sort of the value in the ongoing use case. The way we got started, and of course you always need to pick a niche to get started, is through technical due diligence. And of course, in that moment, the CTO needs to be able to explain of the tuck-in, or we call it the not the tuck-in, the code owner, which could be a either it's a platform deal or buying, being bought by a financial buyer, or a tuck-in being bought by a strategic. But the code owner has to explain that the code base is of sufficient quality, not perfect, but sufficient quality to get purchased. We call that, a moment of evaluation where everyone is incredibly aligned to get to the bottom of it. The board of directors won't make an investment unless they know. The advisors need to know the answer and need to know it quantitatively to be able to tell their customers. And the CTOs from the code owner, the target, are incredibly motivated to present, a good story, but present an accurate story of what's going on with their code. So we started the code scans business with it was 100% diligences. Have the great honor to now have looked at $1 trillion worth of deals for 7 of the 9 largest global software investors, and I'm just so honored by their trust. And then over time, the ongoing use case became more and more prevalent. Well, okay, now how do I make a resource request? We're going to get sold, so we need a sell side prep so that there's no surprises in advance. But starting with that incredible pain point of, well, how good is this code in a diligence, was our anchor point, was our niche when we got started.
Yeah, makes total sense. And yeah, like I said, it's so hard for, but I mean, of course, first of all, to cover for your own business, whether the code is good enough, where the potential leaks are, and security these days. But it's even harder if you look at it in a due diligence setting, and you're pressured on time to figure out, are these guys, what they're saying, is it really true? Because you cannot go through every line of code to assess that. And then you find dead bodies after you've done the deal. Done it and seen it happening. Whereby for some deals you wonder in hindsight, why did we do it? Why didn't we see it? Anyway, 2017, kind of winding back, you saw the problem. You start the business. What I'm always fascinated with is like, where do you start? How do you start? So what was an important decision that you took back then that appears to be, yeah, pretty important for where you are right now?
Well, certainly, I'll give you the answer that comes first to mind. When I decided that this problem of executive insight into code was important, I wanted to have a solid technological foundation for this product, given that we were serving deep technologists. Obviously that was incredibly important. So what I did was turn on Google Scholar, and I spent about a year and a half before the business got started reading academic journal articles about using code to understand code and using code to improve code. Journals, obviously in majority publishing from universities and other nonprofit or government research institutions. I know you know it, but the term of tech transfer means taking good ideas in a laboratory and bringing them and commercializing them. For a variety of reasons, tech transfer is very hard to do. And I knew enough about that space to know that the corollary was that there should be good ideas available to commercialize if you can go find the right ones. I do not recommend this to entrepreneurs. There are other faster ways, but I really wanted to understand the space. So I probably skim read 1,500 journal articles, read 500 of them, contacted 250 scientists, and 249 said some version of no, but all you need is one. The kernel of the first product came from an amazing researcher who was at the University of Michigan and still a very important part of our product. It's part of the architectural assessment, and so honored that University of Michigan's on our cap table. We got really lucky there.
Let me make a small interruption here. Matt just made a critical remark that underpins that durable, defensible differentiation. Focusing on solving the problem comprehensively in a way deep technologists would find worth making a remark about. Yes, this requires to spend more time on research. And yes, this also requires to spend more time in building and testing. But it also led to something that instantly gains trust of the most critical audience they have to convince. People that have to defend their work around the most important moments of their company's lives. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They practice the art of curiosity like no one else, focus on the essence, and then create new value possibilities that instantly stand out. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So again, to your audience who's thinking about being an entrepreneur, that is not the fastest way. The fastest way is to build wireframes, go have customer interviews, and then say, if we build this, will you buy it? But I'm the sort of person who really wanted to make sure I knew the tech before I started designing what the product could look like.
But what has that resulted in when it comes to, what gain did it give you in hindsight? Because I think when I hear you talking about it, you do it again.
So I most certainly didn't do it for the second time. I guess I'd say I would do it once because it was really a deeper education than I had gotten before in understanding the world of code scanning. So I think for that, it was very valuable. It is literally a critical part of our product. So one of the magical things we can do in the code scan is find who the architects are. So we've talked about a code scan, but it actually covers more than just the lines of code. It looks at the developers and what developers are up to. And this kernel of the idea, this IP that we have licensed from the University of Michigan, helps us identify architects. And Tom, that you want to talk about something really fascinating. You show up to an organization with thousands of developers all time, and you say, tell me about Sven, because Sven seems to have really made a big difference to the architectural quality of the code. And everyone's like, how did you know that, right? Well, the answer is we looked at hundreds of millions of lines of code, and the math is the math. Sven genuinely added, made structural changes that are really, really important. So in hindsight, it definitely taught me more about the space that I was entering. It gave us a kernel of a really defensible starting point that would be defensible to engineers about understanding code quality and coder quality. But certainly today we don't run our business that way anymore. We do wireframe, we do go interview, and if they like it, then we go build it, rather than vice versa, starting with the technology and then finding a fit.
Yeah. No, I think but what you've done here is, like you just said, you've created something that gives you defensible differentiation. And that is the essence at the end of enterprise software. I mean, you can talk about any feature and any competitor can say, well, we got those features too. But what you just said, and you said it was the magic, I call that in the repositioning work that I always do, I'm looking for the magic concepts. And I typically try to find three. And when those three, when you bring them together, it gives you something that's deeply defensible. And I think, well, just seeing the faces of people when you, for example, do a demo and you do first scan and getting those type of details out, it instantly brings you the trust. And it's like, okay, you know, you're the chosen one. We're going to call everybody else. The deal is done. That's what you want. So yeah, kudos. And it proves again that sometimes, and you already started with that, doing the hard thing makes sense. Even though in hindsight, you don't want to do it again, but it gave you something that is ultimately valuable, even, what is it, 8-9 years down the road.
Exactly, right.
So what has been on this journey, what has been the toughest decision that you had to make in order to make it grow the way you want it?
We were facing an important milestone last year. We had really gotten our Code Scans product to a very strong and healthy place. And we're then thinking about how we could expand on this base. You talk about doing the hard thing. You know, we've done 900 scans, most of them due diligences. So many conversations and earning trust deal by deal and thinking about all these situations in code. Based building that just fantastic foundation, deciding which direction to go next. Mm-hmm. That was an incredibly, is always, I think, an incredibly challenging decision. And we actually started down a path of what would have been our second product. And we're really getting, you know, getting to know it and getting the shape. We had a prototype of it when some of our customers came to us and said, well, we want you to build this other thing. And so in hindsight, it's a clear decision that we picked the right one. But in that moment, saying, well, do we stop the second product after we've put in this hard work mm-hmm. and move to a third product? It was most certainly not easy at the time.
No, exactly. Because it's the sunk cost that is always playing around.
Exactly right. Exactly.
And we've gone so far right now and throw it all away and give it all up. Do you have a framework for that? I mean, what made you decide to follow, I would say, the advice of your customers?
Yeah, and of course, it wasn't like, you know, product A did not have positive customer feedback and product B did. It was that a second wave, that would have been an easy decision. It was that as we were building product A with positive customer feedback, customers also said, well, we're also interested in product B. So, you know, of course, the North Star is, do people care? Do buyers care? And what I know now that I didn't know as a baby entrepreneur was there are so many different versions of no, except here is some money. Here is the money. Everything else is no. I love it. So interesting. I can really see this helping. This solves a pain point. Yes, I want to pilot. Yes, I want to tell my friends. That's all no. It's all versions of no, except here is some money. And being able to, you know, you have to be a little bit crazy, right? To be an entrepreneur, because you're not going to get, unless you're selling, I think, something illegal and addictive, but coffee's not illegal, even if it's addictive. But other than addictive substances, you have to wait for a bunch of things that are not real yeses until you get to the real yes. But I am certainly 100 times better at that than when I started because of just hard knocks, learning all the different ways that people, it sounds like they're saying yes, because of course they don't want to hurt your feelings and you know, they want to be good people. But the job fundamentally as an entrepreneur is to remove the chaff and see the kernel of what really is there and what isn't there. So that's, I think, part one, just knowing there's only one kind of yes and there's a gazillion kinds of no.
Yeah,
and I think the other thing is it's just not about me. I have an incredible board of directors, an incredible leadership team, incredible colleagues. and I talked at the beginning, our values drive everything we do. They're our operating system, they're our DNA. One of those five core values is growth. Growth includes we ask all the questions we want about anything there is, whether or not that's in our line or not. We ask them, and almost all questions get answered. Tiny ones maybe about people, like I can't answer, but other than that, we're very transparent. And we are deeply committed as an organization to calling each other out. And it's actually literally, if you were to read our values guide, it says people get bonus points when they tell the CEO, me, that the CEO is wrong. And that's very intentional. One, I personally like to grow, and I'm never going to grow if people aren't honest with me. And second, of course, you know about, all of your listeners know about psychological safety. I think that the easiest way to encourage psychological safety and the easiest way to destroy it is to, the easiest way to maintain it is to show that the CEO is part of that too, that you can tell the truth, speaking truth to power. If you, whoever you are in the organization, can say, I don't agree, or you're wrong, it just gives everybody else permission to, oh yeah, we take this seriously. This isn't one set of rules for staff and one set of rules for executives. And so we don't have time to count all of the different ways that colleagues and peers and the board have told me I'm wrong. But we've incorporated all of that into, you know, making the best possible decisions we can every day.
I love that. It's, I mean, chapter 4 of our book is the Remarkable Software Companies Master the Art of Curiosity. And this is a flavor of it.
Exactly,
and it's not
right.
Only at the C-level, it's everywhere in the organization. And if everybody is entitled and motivated to keep asking those questions, yeah, then you end up with a lot of good insights. And these insights become your competitive advantage again. And I mean, I completely agree with you. The way you've done it incentivize people to call you out. I haven't heard it that clear, but it's inspiring. Gosh, yeah, give me a lot of other questions here that I want to ask around that. Still, I want to go a little bit on the getting traction side. So you built your product. What was the market you opted first for? The end user market, CTOs kind of covering their own stuff, or was it more the investors market, because there's two legs on your website?
Yeah. For the first CodeScan business, we started with CTOs looking at their own stuff, yeah. But very quickly realized there was more pull from investors and acquirers. It could be acquiring CTOs, it could be deal teams, it could be corp dev teams, but acquirers, that was the strongest pull. And we heard that from users of it in the ongoing use case saying, oh, this is good, but boy, I could really imagine using it in diligence. And then sharing that and getting that feedback in from advisors, we quickly focused on the tech due diligence use case first.
Exactly. Why do you think that gave the strongest pull? Is it because there's more repetition on the bigger value cases? Because I mean, the moment you got it installed and you look at it every Friday afternoon a bit, and every month a little bit more, versus acquirers that might need it only once or twice a year, but at the end, you know, how many people are acquiring in the world? It's a totally different market.
Yeah, and you know, all of the would-be entrepreneurs or current entrepreneurs out there, you don't need me to say it, but I'm going to say it anyway. That, you know, another way of describing our first business was that it was a series of one-off, predictable, but one-off scans. That is very different from a SaaS business. Generally speaking, the generic advice is go off and build a SaaS business as fast as you can, because SaaS businesses are valued at some multiple of revenue, and non-SaaS businesses are valued at some multiple of EBITDA, right? It is not the conventional path. I do not recommend diverging from the recommended path unless you absolutely know what you're doing and you're really honest with yourself. For us, the North Star has always been, how do we solve this problem at scale? How do we solve the problem of really understand what's going on with code at scale? And understanding it comprehensively, not like There's some absolutely spectacular security tools and individual code quality tools, et cetera, and they've done an amazing job. We have really big ambitions to tell a consolidated story. And to get to a consolidated story, we really believe that the best path was to get it right in moments. And so to actually produce the output we wanted through these one-off scans and learn enough to be able to come to the true, you know, holy grail product down the road. I think the Union Street Ventures built things, do the hard things. And so certainly a 900 code scans where it's not a SaaS business, where we really got to know code bases and investors and sellers. We understand that world. We understand this absolute no BS moment where people are incredibly honest, need to be incredibly honest and rigorous and care about code quality and other related functions. I would not trade that for the world, because now we know this world inside and out based on, you know, the most important moments of companies' lives, frankly, other than maybe foundation. And, you know, to have built a trust-based relationship with, you know, the world's most sophisticated investors and acquirers and operators is an unbelievable gift that we would not have been able to do had we just built, you know, had we taken a different path earlier. So in short, dear listener, I would not do what we did unless you really know what you're doing and you have the support of a great team and you're ready to take that longer path. But to us, to get to the real end goal of what SEMA is and will be, we wanted to do it this way.
Again, it's part of doing the hard things first, but then ending up with something that once you got that position, yeah, it becomes a flywheel, people talking about you. And see what's happening. You know, you get the pull on the investor side, you get the pull on the end user side. How do you see that going forward? Like, is one market accelerating faster than the other? Or is it good to have sort of both in terms of the waves that are always there?
Yeah. I like to think of it in a very micro way, that there is a lot of demand both for the CodeScans product and a lot of demand for measuring Gen AI code detection.
Yeah.
I don't take that for granted for an instant. So many folks try to get to product market fit and do their best and bring their best efforts and everything they can, and it still sometimes doesn't work. There's so much luck and timing that goes into even making it, you know, hit once. And so the fact that we've been able to do it twice is an unbelievable testament to our team, to good fortune, to hard work. And so to have two sets, I mean, some of them are literally overlapping, of course, but to have customers, two sets of customers and customers being interested in two sets of products, both of which growing at a very healthy clip, I just could not be more lucky. I could not be more proud of our team and could not be more appreciative of our customers, and could not be luckier to be running a business like this.
Yeah. Even, by the way, the Gen AI products, and I don't want to play it down, but isn't that just a use case of the product that was already there? It's like a logical evolution of the suite?
I definitely think so. So, and frankly, that was how our customers who asked us to build the second product came to us. Mm-hmm. We think of it sometimes as a home inspection, at least in the United States. If you're buying a house, there's a home inspection, which is a report that looks at the plumbing and the wiring and the roof. Our code scan is comprehensive like that, and then it looks at code quality and security and open source and cyber, and like a home inspection, it's done in, you know, a point of sale or getting ready for sale. One of the parts, you're exactly right, it's a very insightful comment. One of the parts of this code scan is looking at the open source code that a team has used. So what's open source code? It is code that the team did not write. They pulled it for free from the community, you know, could be written by one person or millions of people. It's an incredibly good idea to use open source. If you asked a developer, would you like to not use open source? They'd look at you like you're crazy, because it makes them more productive. It makes them happier because they're not reinventing the wheel. But open source code is risky. It has security risk. Not that other code doesn't, but it has security risk you need to check. It has intellectual property risk, et cetera. And so for years and years and years, SEMA was scanning for open source risk in diligences. and two of our most thoughtful and innovative customers, who I will not name because we like to protect confidences, but I will say thank you, you know who you are, said, well, you're observing open source composition. Please evaluate Gen AI composition. And what's Gen AI? It's code they didn't write. You know, you might have prompted it, but the person, the thing that wrote it was an LLM. It makes developers more productive, but for sure, developers don't like it being taken away from them, so that's in their interest. But Gen AI code is also not secure. It Gen AI hallucinates, and that means security risk. It also comes with IP risk, et cetera, et cetera. And so couldn't agree more with your astute observation. It is just one more pillar of evaluating a code base. It just happens to be a very new one that is rapidly increasing in importance.
Yeah, exactly. Since this market is developing so fast, and I haven't done a lot of study in terms of competitors in your space, but what has been a challenge when it comes to, yeah, maybe first of all getting traction, but maybe now at this moment differentiation?
Yeah. So let me think about that. In the earliest days of the Gen AI product, you know, we had a hypothesis that some organizations were so concerned about the risk of Gen AI code that they would want to ban it. And not only would they want to ban it, they would actually want to enforce that ban. So to really keep Gen AI code out, you know, if you think the risks are more serious than the benefits, you could not only set a policy, but you might enforce it. And so we had a hypothesis that those organizations that were really afraid of Gen AI code would be our first set of customers, because frankly, it's really the only way to actually enforce whether or not the policy is happening is to just check, because otherwise you're just talking. It turned out that was not true. Even among the organizations who had explicit policy saying no Gen AI code, told us off the record, we'd really rather not check. We'd really rather not check. Now, that's not something you can do with Sarbanes-Oxley compliance. There's many levels of compliance that you can't just put your head in the sand and not pay attention to. But given that these were self-set standards of, you know, policies that we're not going to use it, they could make a choice not to observe. So that is something. Shout out anyone out there who still doesn't want your developers to use it, which is not CIMA's recommendation. We do think you should. But if you have a policy, I do recommend you check on it and feel free to give us a call. Feel free to give us a call. So that was one of the early adoption risks. You know, not just risks; it just didn't happen. And so it turned out after a lot of experimentation and, you know, really trying to ask the hard questions of who cares the most, that the first and most prominent adopters are private equity backed software companies or tech enabled companies, because they believe that in a future due diligence, they will be inspected for their Gen AI code composition. And it turns out that that is a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the same investors who said, please start inspecting for this for diligence. So listeners out there, there is a meaningful chance that if you're going to get diligence this year in a software company, you're going to have to explain how much Gen AI code you have. A meaningful chance, because that is our market share of diligence providers. Well, that ends up creating a market for the SaaS product to observe it in advance. So that I should have answered earlier that that's a real benefit having these two products, which are very complementary. And so the growth in the Gen AI SaaS product came in part because Gen AI detection is part of our diligence, and we are the only folks who do it in diligence. So if you want to know how much Gen AI code is in a deal you're doing or what it's going to say, we're the only place you can go. And so that is, I'm not worried about differentiation. This is a giant market, you know, $1 billion TAM. Plenty of folks will enter. That just shows that it's an important industry, and I very much like our chances given our position that we'll do just fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, you just explained how you build it up and try kind of deal with that. You know, try to get ahead 7 years a lot. Try to kind of overrun that in a market that is just taking speed.
Yeah.
Looking at the time, well, one thing that fascinated me, well, before you started SEMA and became the CEO of it, you were a VP of customer support at a company called Social Solutions. How has that job set you up to be who you are right now and to do the job that you are right now in such a good way?
We'll see. Verdict might be out on how well I'm doing it, but it's certainly, you know, all of my past experiences have informed at least. Generally speaking, I was a management consultant earlier in my career, which was great on structuring and synthesizing and problems and seeing things for what they could be, not as they are today. That was fabulous. And then I spent about a decade as a data and analytics leader. And for my family, I was already predisposed to thinking about how can we solve problems through data. And in customer support, definitely data helps inform how to have a great customer experience and optimize the financials associated with it. Mm-hmm. And just being very facile and excited about and curious about data was one of the reasons that, seeing the absence of data on the code side really just made the gap so much clearer. We know so much about a customer support organization. And at the time, we knew so little about the engineering organizations that gap really drove me. I will answer a slightly different question because it's fun, which is, serving as an executive in medium to large existing organizations, while it definitely taught me a lot about leadership and management, was a fundamentally different approach to leading and managing than a startup CEO. And I made, it took a really long time to really make the transition. I'm still learning today. I'll give some unsolicited career advice to your listeners. I like to think about, for those of us who've blessed to have a lot of career opportunities, a really beautiful thing about a career is finding closer and closer to your best fit. And the only way you can do that is by experimenting and trying out different roles. Of course, you want to solve for comp and location, et cetera. But I think most of us are very happy in particular industries. Like there's just some things we care about more than others. Particular roles, CEOing, COOing, sales, whatever, like some you like more of those differently. People know about that, but a really underappreciated part about job satisfaction is company stage. And I really encourage folks early or mid in their careers at least to experiment by going to organizations that are at different stages. In my view, there are 4, 0 to 1, 1 to 7 to 8, 8 to 10, and then used to be 10 and now 5. So starting, rapid growth, excellence, and you're trying to stay excellent or turnaround. My experience is they feel very different, and most people only like 1 or 2 of those 4 stages. And the sooner you can try those 4 stages, the sooner you can figure out where you are the happiest. I really like being an entrepreneur, but my second favorite is turnarounds. We just have to achieve these goals. There's very tight constraints. It's going to be a tough situation, but we're going to recover. Most people only like a few of them, at most, let's say 2. And so figuring that out and then realizing that I had to be different about being a startup leader than how I was in a mature organization was a big learning curve for me.
Well said. I completely agree with you. I mean, I have had the opportunity to grow with an organization and I stayed there for a very long time in different roles. So I've been able to look at various things and gain the experience that I've got these days. And these days I work also with different stages of companies, and I can definitely just smell also from the outside where I'm at my best and where you get most energy from. And that matters, Someone that is at his best or at her best in an organization that is like 500 million and is growing towards the billion, when they arrive at a startup, they can be miserable. And the other way around, It's just what dynamics you like. Good. Last question. From the tidbits of wisdom that you've gained over time now running the company, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other aspiring tech entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs that want to take the business to the next level?
I'll start with the don't. I think the don't, to be provocative, is don't start a startup, which is to say you have to be so crazy to invest so much of your time and energy into starting something when there's plenty of opportunity through entrepreneurship. There's so many ways to build something and have that sense of building that you have to be absolutely certain that it's the right fit for you relative to the alternatives, and have 50 people tell you no and still want to do it and still have a plan and still be able to make it work and still have backup, and then only do it then. But so many other ways you can get to, you know, checking the box of what's satisfying about a startup than doing it. So the don't is don't start one. And then if you 50 conversations later, you still want to, then it could be the right fit. It could be the right fit. And then I think in terms of do, I think the thing that comes most to mind, and especially this is different coming from a more of a corporate setting, is it really is okay for it to be a singular vision. And I think I didn't understand that at the beginning. You know, if I was showed up as an executive with an existing company, I would take the current values, I'd reflect on them, we'd go through a workshop together, and, you know, come up with a blend of what I thought, you know, the values might, what we thought the values might be for the future. I actually did that the first, you know, first 2 years of SEMA, and it didn't work. And then I realized we're just going to use mine, and you can like my values, and you'll have a great time here or not, and you're not the right fit. But it's not consensus. It is, the values are my vision, and folks come here have to follow them. And that, I don't know, felt too egotistical or not collaborative or whatever, but that is the only way. The only way to make a startup go as fast as possible is a very, very small number of people, one or two max, their vision is what you're carrying out. It's not a consensus. It is going in this direction because you just have so little resources to be able to achieve what you want to achieve.
Well said. Where can people go to find out more about SEMA or to say hi to you?
Oh, I would always love to hear from folks. SEMASoftware.com, that's S-E-M-A, and software, all one word. And I'm always delighted to hear from people, especially your listeners. You can write at mvi@semasoftware.com or forms and ask for Matt. They'll get to me.
Good. Well, thank you very much for sharing the story and the wisdom. Fascinating. I learned a couple of things and definitely take notice of that. And I think the people that are listening to this will do the same. So good luck on the next part of the journey.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Pleasure. And this ends my conversation with Matt. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Matt van Italy, founder and CEO of SEMA. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.